it's not our regular music, but a little sample of the Viper and his famous orchestra. They're featured at the annual CU Folk and Roots Festival in downtown Urbana this weekend. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, you'll hear a conversation re-recorded with festival organizers Brenda Koenig and Matt Winters. Then I'll talk to banjoist and music researcher Stephen Wade, who's also playing at the Folk and Roots Festival. We'll talk about the sense of community created by making folk and roots music and how the music made today is shaped by long-standing traditions. Folk and Roots music on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The Champaign-Urbana area has a host of festivals throughout the year, a host of music festivals, and one of them is coming up this weekend in downtown Urbana. It's the Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, the fifth annual edition, I believe, taking place in various venues in downtown Urbana. And I'm pleased to have two of the organizers of the festival with me during this first part of Focus today. Later on, we'll be talking with one of the performers coming up at the festival, and that's Stephen Wade, folk musician and writer and author as well. We'll be talking about his new book as well as his music at the festival. But with me right now is the chair of the executive board of the CU Folk and Roots Festival, Brenda Koenig. Welcome to Focus.
Thanks for having me.
And also with me on the steering and booking committees is Matt Winters, also active with the CU Folk and Roots Festival.
Jim, good to be here. Okay.
Brenda, you pretty much got the ball rolling with this festival. Was it 5 years ago now?
Yeah, it was in the end of 2008, at the beginning of 2009. We started looking for volunteers, canvassing the community of people that we knew involved in the folk music and folk dance and storytelling. We canvassed everyone and tried to get everyone together to see if there was enough momentum and volunteerism out there to do a folk festival. I think I knew it was going to be a large endeavor.
Okay, not just a career move for you. This is a music, I take it, that you love deeply.
Yes, exactly. I don't think it would be a career move. It's probably kind of an anti-career move, actually. I love folk music. It's something that I feel very deeply about. I feel very strongly about folk music because of its accessibility, that anyone can do it. It is not necessarily a type of music that you have to have a lot of expertise or performance background to play. This is music that should be played with other people. It's a kind of social type of music, and I feel very strongly that that's very important to humanity.
And that's what's important to you. This is, I mean, I confess I like folk music, but I like it to listen to. I don't imagine myself as a folk musician, but the idea of folk music is it's done by folk.
Exactly, exactly. And really, even people who listen to folk music, they're part of the circle. So, you know, a really important lyric to me is, "Will the circle be unbroken?" And it is about everybody, everybody belongs in the circle. There's a place for everyone in the circle of music.
And of course, not everybody who might organize a folk festival is a folk musician, but you did bring a fiddle with you.
Yeah. I am a fiddle player. Back in the 1990s, I decided that's what I wanted to do. I had played a little bit of violin in middle school, like many people. And I had a lot of friends who were in rock bands or playing music. I kind of socialized on the fringes of a alt country scene in Chicago. And so I kind of was being exposed to roots music. And so I grabbed that violin, dusted it off, and walked into the Old Town School of Folk Music in 1990 about, and started playing.
What was the difference for you between, oh, say, if you would go back to your childhood music lessons and then learning to play in the folk music tradition? How did that feel different?
That was so different. That's a really good question. Thanks for asking. I probably had a particularly difficult kind of musical background. I had a very strict German violin teacher in middle school, and if I even moved my leg slightly, she would kind of hit it with her bow, my leg with her bow. I remember crying a lot. I remember my parents, there was a lot of pressure to practice. And so when I returned to music, it was a completely different experience for me. It was something that I wanted to do. It was motivated by my desire to really kind of connect with people socially. And that was just it was completely different. That's all I can say.
Well, you have the fiddle with you. Maybe you could grace us with a piece of music.
Sure. There are a lot of really pivotal kind of personalities in the Chicago area playing this kind of music in the 1990s. And one of those people was a fiddler who's still one of the best fiddlers in the Midwest, Lynn Chirp Smith. Everyone calls him Chirps. And he's the kind of guy who'll sit down with just about anybody and teach him a tune. You can actually even show up at his doorstep. He'll invite you in for the weekend and you'll come away a better fiddler. So this is a tune that he taught me called Bumblebee on a Sweet Potato Vine.
Bumblebee on a Sweet Potato Vine, played by Brendan Koenig, one of the organizers of the CU Folk and Roots Festival. Are you performing at the festival yourself?
No, actually, I'm not. I really, really enjoy putting the festival together and walking around and seeing how people are enjoying it and troubleshooting some of the issues that come up. So really putting myself into a performance role is something that I never thought about and never wanted to do.
Jim, let me tell you, if you stay up late enough, if you make it to the late night jam sessions at the festival, you might see Brenda pull out her fiddle then.
That's one thing I wanted to ask about. And in a moment, Matt, I want to get to some of the artists that you wanted to showcase at the festival. But the interactive part with the jam sessions, et cetera, tell me a little about that.
Right. From the very beginning, from 2009 on, one of our goals was to make sure that the festival was focused on participatory events, really activities that would allow people to actually interact with each other and make sure that everybody's being involved in the music scene. So actually half of our 91 events this year are participatory activities, whether they're jams, workshops, sing-alongs. No matter how good you are, there's a place for you to be involved and to be active in the folk music scene, as well as storytelling and other things.
You know, one thing that occurred to me as I listened to this music, and, you know, a lot of field music, this is dance music.
Absolutely.
Have you ever seen any people dance to traditional field music?
This is absolutely dance music. The way it's structured, everything about it is meant to be accompanied, to accompany dancers. I think that the idea that this is, once again, a community event, that this isn't music to be listened to necessarily in rows of chairs and a stage. This is music to be in someone's living room or in the barn or kind of to be celebrated and be part of a kind of general fun event.
Well, Matt, I understand you came here to Champaign-Urbana from New York State?
New York City, even.
New York City, okay. And yet, even in the stratified depths of New York City, you were pursuing music like this.
That's true. I mean, it was not my main activity in New York. I was a student, but during all of my student years in New York City, I was the host of a bluegrass radio show on the Columbia University radio station, carrying on a program that had begun back in 1963 and is still going even now that I've gone.
That's the Moonshine Show at WCKR Radio.
WKCR. And KCR was a great place. It's mostly a jazz and classical radio station, but over on the weekends we bust out some bluegrass, old time, and blues, and other types of music that you can hear at the Folk and Roots Festival.
When you started working on the Moonshine Show, for instance, was that music that you already knew and loved, or did you come to know and love it through that activity?
A little bit of both. So I had grown up in folk music, and my father actually is a folk music radio DJ in Southern Connecticut, where he's had a show called Profiles in Folk for some 40 years now. That's on WSHU-FM out of Fairfield, Connecticut. And I had gotten a fair amount of exposure to bluegrass through going to folk festivals and going to concerts. And I liked sort of a particular type of bluegrass, which is known as newgrass, which is a little more contemporary, draws on maybe the sounds of rock and roll and R&B sometimes. And when I took over the Moonshine Show, the previous host was much more of a traditional bluegrass fan. And so I quickly had to learn the tastes of the audience to some extent, which were much more traditional than my own. And so there was this bluegrass from the 1940s and 50s that I didn't know that much about. And so I had a little bit of a learning curve on that front. And then I kind of drank the Kool-Aid fully and you know, became an arch-traditionalist and was never playing the stuff that I had first gotten into the music with.
Well, now you're here in Champaign-Urbana and working on this festival. What sort of performers are we seeing here this weekend?
We just have an extremely diverse lineup this weekend. We've got a couple of bluegrass acts, a gospel bluegrass group called Mackville Bluegrass, and a quartet of women out of Bloomington, Indiana called the Whipstitch Sallies. But then we have singer-songwriters coming up from Austin, Texas. We have a Cajun accordionist up from Louisiana. We've got these youngsters down from Chicago called the Birds of Chicago.
Now tell me a little bit more about them.
They're a duo. Sometimes they perform with a much fuller band, and they're a really interesting group. They could be at home at an indie rock festival, but at the same time, there's something about their music that's really rooted in the tradition such that they're at home at a folk and roots festival, too. They're a group that's been gaining a lot of attention, watching a bit of a meteoric rise with these guys. So I think we're really lucky to be having them into the festival this year. A couple of years from now, they might be too big for us.
50 years ago, might have talked about certain musical acts as being folk rock acts. Does that category still apply, do you think?
It still exists. We, Brenda and I get together and we have long debates about genres and what exactly the appropriate genre is for some of the acts at the festival. So this is a group, the Birds of Chicago, that you could call folk rock for sure.
Okay. What other musical strains come into the mix at the festival?
We're going to have a wonderful night on Friday night at the Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana that's going to feature a lot of Irish and Celtic music. So Kate Fritz, who's a local fiddler who plays a number of different sort of Scottish and Cape Breton style fiddle. And then Mike Kirkpatrick and Kathleen Keane, who played with this seminal Chicago Irish band called the Drovers. And they're going to play some kind of straight ahead Irish stuff. And then Kathleen writes her own songs, so some contemporary material. And then a woman named Laura Cortese, who just blends together all. She's got a Celtic basis, but she'll pluck from anywhere and put it into the mix there.
Okay. You know, I'm wondering, Brenda, when you put together a festival like this, how you make it work financially. For instance, are the ticket sales for this paying for everything?
That's a good question. We do a lot of fundraising over the course of the year. We're really blessed with 5, 6, 7, 8 of us that are dedicated volunteers to work on this throughout the year. We start in February. We write grants, we beg, we borrow, we steal, we do anything we can to make sure that we can cover the costs of this festival. We also are committed to right now being in downtown Urbana so that many of our venues are venues where the businesses are actually benefiting. So when drinks or food are being served, that those monies are going to the local economy, going into the businesses of downtown Urbana. We are not able to then use that money for the festival. So we're kind of treading the fine line between making sure that we are 100% community based and also sufficient, self-sufficient and sustainable into the future. So that's some place that we're going to have to take a look at every year we come together and try to figure out, you know, what we're going to do in the future, how we're going to get the money. And we're very, very grateful for many organizations and corporations, businesses that support us, especially the Urbana Public Arts Commission. It just was kind of happenstance. But in 2009, we had our first festival, and they also – it was the first year that they ran their public arts grant program. And so that program actually provided the seed money for our first festival.
But it sounds like it is a sort of a year-to-year proposition. You're not sure right now if there's going to be a 2014 CU Folk and Roots Festival.
Oh, I think we're pretty sure that there will be one. We're doing better year after year in terms of being able to have seed money for the following year. Because no one's being paid, we're able to make sure that there's money to start up again in the following year.
What sort of turnout are you seeing? And I'm not, although I'm curious about things like number of people, but what sort of enthusiasm do you see from the audience for this type of music?
Terrific enthusiasm, larger crowds each and every year. And I think one of the things that we've come to realize is being, volunteer-run festival, relying on local sources of finances and donations, is that we can't necessarily book the biggest name acts. And so one of the coolest things about the festival is that we put acts up on that stage who most people in the audience haven't heard of. And so last year we had this group in from British Columbia called the Tequila Mockingbird Orchestra. And just a few scattered people in town had probably ever heard of this group. But the room was packed and people loved it. People were up and dancing and just having a great time with this band.
One of the bands, and I confess the only name that I recognized on the lineup myself personally was the Viper and its Famous Orchestra. And tell me a little bit about them and what sort of music they bring.
Well, the Viper is a repeat Folk and Roots Festival performer. We had him here a couple of years ago, and you never know what he's going to bring, actually. But he's doing some great programming in the afternoon, part of our family programming. So he's going to do a make-and-take, build-your-own-instrument workshop, and that's going to progress into our annual Musical Mayhem Parade. We invite all the kids in town to come and make an instrument and join in this parade around downtown Urbana. And then he'll be doing a family set, and then this is where you got to stay up a little bit late. At the Iron Post, the Viper's going to be doing an adult set.
Yeah.
Now, the type of music, when I hear a phrase like that, the Viper and its Famous Orchestra, it evokes to me something of early swing music, maybe a little Cab Calloway, a little Duke Ellington from circa 1930. Am I close in guessing what he likes to draw on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, good time music.
Yeah, he's really kind of a jug band type of musician.
So not say the traditional jazz big band, but we're talking about a different instrumentation here.
Yeah. In fact, they have a drummer, but he doesn't drum on a drum kit. He drums on a suitcase kit.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Something that can – a band that can set up just about anywhere, it sounds like.
Yeah, they're pretty flexible.
There's a storytelling aspect to the festival as well. Has that been a regular thing?
Yeah, we have had storytellers. One thing that's really cool about our festival is we really try to incorporate all the folk organizations here in town. It's kind of an opportunity for them to showcase what they do and to get everyone together in a community aspect. So the CU Storytelling Guild has been around forever, and that would be led primarily by Kim Sheehan, a storyteller here in town who's fantastic. And they have been involved ever since 2009. They are always at the library, and we bring in usually a performer, a storyteller from further afield that they enjoy, that they want to have here. And this year we have Dan Ketting, who actually is the first time. He's actually a local teller. He's one of our featured storytellers, but this is the first time since 2009 that he's actually been in town during the festival. So we're very excited that he'll be here this year. And we also have Oba William King coming down from Chicago, an African-American storyteller who I met in Central Illinois when I was with my kids doing a summer camp over at the Sun Foundation near Peoria.
Tell me the audience reaction you've gotten on the storytelling. Has that been able to draw people in?
Yeah. You know, last year I was really amazed. I mean, I think that it's really exciting to see an entire auditorium filled up with people wanting to listen to stories. I'm not sure that happens very often, and it was just one of the most beautiful things I saw last year when our tellers had, you know, 50, 60, 70 people in the audience.
And I know that one of the people, I guess, during the showcase, the storytelling showcase portion during the festival, Camille Bourne was on our program last week. We were actually talking specifically about scary stories in that case, because she also did a presentation during last week, a walking tour of, I guess, haunted downtown Champaign. Emphasize that she's good at telling a scary story, I must admit.
Yeah, there's something really powerful about being in the presence of someone telling you a story. So much of what we do these days is kind of mediated by the media in some way, either through, you know, the computers or television, the big screen. But if you're sitting right next to somebody and they're telling you a scary story, there's absolutely nothing more powerful than that. It raises the hair on the back of your neck, for sure.
None of the venues I'm looking, the Independent Media Center, the Iron Post, the Heartland Gallery, the Landmark Hotel, and Bouvans. Did I have them all written there?
And the Rose Bowl as well.
And how can I forget the Rose Bowl? None of these are huge venues. Which one would you say would actually be the biggest?
The Independent Media Center is the one that can hold the most, in the old post office building there in downtown Urbana, and that serves as our festival central. So that's where people can go and purchase their wristbands for the festival, and where our volunteers check in, things like that.
And maybe the nuts and bolts for people are wondering if they can afford this sort of thing. That if you, like, a wristband for the entire festival is $30.
That's right.
And it's $20 for an evening, and then for a single venue, it might be $5 to $15.
That's right. And all the information is up on the website, which is folkandroots.org, so people can figure out which option they want to go with. We think that the all-weekend wristband's a pretty good deal, but we've made some other options available for people, too.
We also have a lot of free events. Everything during the day on Saturday is free. All our workshops and sing-alongs, family programming, everything is free, and so really the evening performances are what we use wristbands for.
The best place online to find out information for the festival? There's a website, and there's also a Facebook page.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, the website has all the information, folkandroots.org, but we encourage people to go to the Facebook page and like it. We've been doing a countdown to the festival, so for the past 25 days now, people have been getting music videos from different performers at the festival in their Facebook news feed if there are fans on Facebook. So we do ask people to go and like the festival there.
This is the sort of question I can't ask about what's going to happen out of the ordinary at this festival, because you may not know if it's going to happen yet. But what's happened at past festivals that really surprised you?
So there was this great moment last year near the green room area where our performers hang out at the IMC before they go on stage. And Blind Boy Paxton, who we had 2 years in a row, this great young blues player from New York who's really just living deep in the tradition, and in about five different traditions, in fact. And he'll pick up almost any instrument that's sitting around. He'll play with anybody who's in the area. And so there was, Brenda, it was Dale Evans, right?
Dale
Evans had the hurdy-gurdy there.
The Dale Evans.
The Dale Evans, as far as I know.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the late wife of Roy Rogers. But
Not that Dale Evans.
No. But as
the
far as—
The Central Illinois Dale
Evans. Yeah, that the Dale Evans.
Okay. Tell me about that Dale Evans.
Well, Dale Evans supported the festival in various ways over the years, but had a instrument booth where he could play with these different instruments. And so he had a hurdy-gurdy.
Right?
Renaissance French instrument where you turn the crank and the wheel spins and it plays fiddle strings. And so he's playing the hurdy-gurdy, and Blind Boy Paxton comes over with his banjo, two instruments you don't normally see together, and starts jamming along with the hurdy-gurdy. Right. And this is just happening off to the side, not a main stage event. But, you know, for the few of us who were there to be able to witness this, it was something pretty special.
In some ways, it just sounds heavenly. I don't know why. And I've never heard a hurdy-gurdy
banjo. No one has ever said that before about the banjo and the hurdy-gurdy. But it was definitely special. Heavenly, maybe.
Brenda, are there any moments in past festivals that stand out for you?
Yeah. Last year was a great festival. It was Saturday night. It was towards the end of the festival, and I was pretty tired. So basically, I just sat on the floor over at the Rose Bowl, which I don't know what I was thinking. But I was on the floor, and a band, Devil in the Woodpile, was there, a kind of a jug band. And it was just a beautiful moment. They don't play on the stage. There's a upright bass, a banjo player, guitar player. I'm trying to remember all their instrumentation. They have quite a few different instruments they play. But they just pick up their instruments and they plop down in the middle of the crowd. And that's how they play. And they were playing they were possessed. They were just spirits that were possessed. And everybody in the crowd just really were jamming along with them. There was wild dancing. It was almost cult-like. It was just a real religious experience. And Eric Noden, who sings with them, he has a way of just throwing his voice. He sounds like he's singing into a microphone, and he's not. And it was beautiful. I was like in tears.
Well, this sounds like a festival where all sorts of things could happen. You have several venues over 2 days. I'm wondering, for people who want to get, who want to buy the entire package, are the wristbands for the two nights pretty easy to pick up? Where do you go?
They're very easy to pick up. You can go on to Brown Paper Tickets. There's a link on our website and get those tickets. Or you can go to the Heartland Gallery. She has some right now. Or most people pick them up at the venues when they go. So let's say you want to start out the night at the Iron Post or at the Heartland Galleries, you can just go and buy your wristband there, or at the Festival Central at the Independent Media Center. We have them there as well. We do want to say that if there is something that people are particularly interested in listening to get there a little bit early this year, because some of our venues will probably sell out.
You've had that experience.
We have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brenda, would you grace us with another song?
Sure. I can play another fiddle tune. I could probably play fiddle tunes all night. I will play, a tune, one of the first tunes I learned over at Old Town School. This is a tune called Snake River Reel, and I think I first heard it from the Ilmo Boys, a string band that was actually from right around here.
Thank you very much, Brenda Koenig and Matt Winters, two of the organizers of the CU Folk and Roots Festival, the fifth edition, coming up in downtown Urbana on Friday and Saturday. Folkandroots.org is your website. Coming up in a moment, one of the performers at the Folk and Roots Festival, Stephen Wade, will be our guest, and that's coming up in just a moment on Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus, live here on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're previewing the fifth annual CU Folk and Roots Festival tomorrow in downtown Urbana. Earlier in the program, we spoke with two of the festival organizers. Now let's meet one of the performers. Stephen Wade is a performer of traditional folk music. He is also a researcher and historian of traditional folk music. And one thing he's made a particular study of are the field recordings of traditional music collected by the Library of Congress. He produced a CD anthology of recordings of, and he's holding it out for me so I can tell you it's a treasury of Library of Congress field recordings selected and annotated by Stephen Wade. That came out in
October 97.
And from that came a book.
Yeah.
That a book and CD that came out just last year from the University of Illinois Press. Mm-hmm. The Beautiful Music All Around Us, Field Recordings and the American Experience, which really focuses in on 13 particular recordings and the artists behind them.
Yeah. They had their stories and their stories hadn't been told before, and it was a wonderful adventure. I spent 18 years altogether from beginning to end on this book traveled all around us. And these recordings took place in homes and in churches and schoolhouses and prisons. And so I went to all the places where all of the recordings had taken place and tried to seek out either the performers themselves, which in a couple of cases I was fortunate enough to meet. They were rather elderly, and family members and community members. And so it was and I'm still doing that because I'm still going around back to those places.
And you're talking about trying to research recordings made about maybe 70 years ago.
That's right. The materials I focused on were recordings made between 1934 and 1942.
Okay. And this is music that really informs your own playing and the music that you've been playing all your life.
It does, and so does the process of learning that music. So these recordings from the 30s inspired really my teacher to play, and who instructed me to go out and learn from the people who know how to do it. He got that idea, I'm sure, from these recordings, because those experiences are sort of mirroring and converging upon one another. And that's what I've done all my life. I was fortunate because I play the five-string banjo, and the person who taught me, whose name was Fleming Brown, learned from a man named Doc Hopkins. And Doc had come up to Chicago from eastern Kentucky in Harlan County to sing on the National Barn Dance for 22 years.
The old WLS National Barn Dance.
Yeah. And so Fleming would take lessons from Doc at 5:30 in the morning. Doc had a morning wake-up show called Smile a While Show. And after the Smile a While Show, Fleming and Doc would get together at the station. And Doc would show him stuff on the banjo. He said, I can't teach you, but I can show you. And so he was really, in saying that really sort of profound distinction, he was working between the formal book learning world, teach but show, and that was the informal world that he knew and he had grown up in. And of course, he did both teach him and show him how to play. And then so when I was a teenager, I was very fortunate, because I was Doc's accompanist, and I played with Doc till the end of his life. I met him around 1971 or two, and he actually outlived Fleming. Doc was born in 1900, and he died in 1988, and we played right up till the end. And mm-hmm. And so I had Doc and I had Fleming, so I had a father and a grandfather in this music who really cared about me and showed me stuff, and also told me when I sounded like a piano falling down a staircase, you know, which was Fleming's phrase for what I sounded like. And so, at times, so it was, they cared enough to be honest about it.
I wanted, you brought some of your instruments with you.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you to play a piece that is showcased in the book, The Beautiful Music All Around Us, and that's, and also in the CD that comes with it. And that's a piece that comes from a man named Pete Steele.
Yeah, Pete was born in the late 19th century, also from Kentucky. He's from eastern Kentucky, lived in Laurel, Kentucky, and he moved to southern Ohio, to Hamilton, Ohio. And in 1938, he was recorded by the Library of Congress. There's only one banjo song in my book, and the song that you're talking about, the tune, is a piece called The Coal Creek March. Mm-hmm. And what I'd like to, if I may, first play for you is Pete Steele's arrangement of the prototype to that tune, and then maybe we can get to that tune. But that tune is a rebuilding of an older tune called the Spanish Fandango. Spanish Fandango, which is neither Spanish nor a fandango, was a really popular primer tune, a learning tune, in print since 1830s, early 1830s. It was already in print, and there were dozens and dozens. And I think I played through 30 or 40 versions of the sheet music versions of the tune between 1832 and 1900, just to explore the many arrangements that were available. This is how Pete Steele. Sort of how Pete Steele played it on the banjo, the Spanish Fandango.
Okay. Spanish Fandango.
From Pete Steele.
And, you know, I can hear little bits. I can hear, like, maybe the chords and right. and maybe a little bit of musical phrasing from the piece, I guess, you're about to play.
The Coal Creek March, right. It's the same. It's the pattern. It'll sound different, but the pattern working the outside string and the chords are exactly right. It's the same harmonic pattern. All right. So I've got to do that. He did that in a different key, in a different...
I think it was Theodore Bakel who once said in a concert I heard a recording of that you're only supposed to follow this part by saying, close enough for folk music.
Oh, well, Pete Steele wouldn't have stood for that. Apparently, when he recorded, it took all day long to do it, to tune it. And Romax was complaining about it in the liner notes, in field notes, about how much time he spent tuning it.
So that is Pete Steele's Coal Creek March.
Well, that's Steve Wade's Pete Steele's Coal Creek March. You got to hear Pete do it, but yeah, that's it, yeah.
Well, yeah. It does sound similar. I was listening to the field recording of Pete Steele playing it.
Yeah.
And what struck me was, as you mentioned in the book, Pete Seeger, the folk singer who's still with us in his 90s, learned that piece of music and fell in love with it. It has many times expressed how beautiful he thinks it is. And he has performed it often.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, I remember as a college kid, I at one point hosted a folk music show down at WSIU Radio in Carbondale. I would open the show with a Pete Seeger recording of Cold Creek Marsh.
You did?
But Pete Seeger played it differently. He repeated phrases. He would join some of those phrases together. And it was surprising. I listened to the Pete Steele recording last night for the first time. Usually I find it's the first version of a piece that I hear that I end up falling in love with. But I would say that the Pete Steele version beat the Pete Seeger version. It was just, there was just something about it that I couldn't put my finger on.
Well, there are different players with different points of view about it, too. I mean, Pete Seeger used the piece often in a medley with other pieces to do with labor history. For Pete Steele, it was a piece of labor history. It was a memorial to men burned in a mine and killed in a mining accident that had occurred in Coal Creek, Tennessee, in early part of the 20th century, 1902, at Fraterville. And it was a memorial in his mind. And he had been a miner, so he was passionate about it. And he was an instrumental representation of what he thought was a brass band that had played around the miners at the time, the bodies at the time of the, soon after the accident.
That's interesting because, you know, I'm hearing a flowing stream when I hear that piece of music. It's something just very light and bright. And the idea that it is actually a memorial for people who died violently is just very surprising.
Well, I mean, for him it was an elegy, even though he described in terms of a brass band idea and a march to do with that. And there's more history involved in why he said that, which I try to explore in the book, and probably time prevents us now from, but there was real good reasons why he said what he said. And that idea of a sort of a rippling brook, you know, Pete Seeger actually described it that way himself, that the movement, the pinpoint of notes that's, and all the arpeggios and stuff. But, you know, instrumental music can be assigned different meanings, certainly. It's not bound by there are no lyrics per se to this song, but Pete still did another song. Also, again, varying on that Spanish Fandango pattern in yet another tuning called Payday at Coal Creek, which is sort of a blues.
Uh-huh.
And that was about a different accident which had historically occurred in the Coal Creek community, which is a hugely beleaguered community with terms of labor uprisings and mine accidents that affected this community profoundly, and that he saw in relation to those accidents and incidents that had happened there.
Okay. You chose 13 particular pieces of music when you did the book.
Yeah.
And were there pieces of music that really stood out for you, or were they pieces of music that had good stories behind them?
Oh, well, both go hand in hand together, and you know, that's a good question. All of the pieces of music in my book are Southern, all of them are there, but there's a great distribution of black and white singers, instrumental and song accompaniments, a cappella, just songs themselves sung by a single voice. There's religious, there's secular, so the uses of the song differ. There's children's songs, there's a variety of settings and persons involved in it, in all of it. So there's a great, I think, kind of a good cross-section, even though there's only 12 performers or groups involved in the 13 songs that I write about.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're speaking with Stephen Wade, a musician and music historian. He is performing three times during the two-day CU Folk and Roots Festival in downtown Urbana. You'll be performing, I guess, with a group on Friday night at the Iron Post.
Yeah.
What sort of setup do you do there?
Oh, it'll be a new thing. It's wonderful. I get to play with three members of the Prairie Dogs, and they're just fabulous. It's Jordan. You probably know these persons, Jordan Kay and Josh Hutchin, And Dave Madden.
Okay. What sort of music do you do with them?
Well, we've been putting together the arrangements. So we're going to be doing a bunch of songs that appeared on my most recent album, for one thing, and that's this one here, Banjo Diary, Lessons from Tradition. And so we'll be doing different, some marches, some reels, R-E-E-L-S, songs.
Now, Banjo Diary, Lessons from Tradition is released by Smithsonian Folkways.
Yeah.
This looks like you about 40 years ago.
Well, I would
guess.
That picture on the cover, that was taken in July 13th, 1982, according to the liner.
Okay, well, let's make it 30 years ago. But who's the gentleman with the banjo?
That was
you?
Virgil Anderson from the, Rocky Branch, Kentucky. He lived on the Cumberland Plateau, and he was just a wonderful guy and a terrific player. And, oh, by the way, he played versions of the Spanish Fandango, too.
Okay.
Yeah, he called it the French Waltz. Mm. Yeah. And so I get to play with those great guys tomorrow night. I'm really looking forward to that.
But you also have two things that you're doing on Saturday as well.
Yes, I'm doing a program about the book itself and with slides and me playing and talking and some sound recordings. And I'm also doing a one-hour banjo concert as well, or workshop.
Okay, so talking about the book happens about the noon hour, mm-hmm. and that's at the Independent Media Center, the old post office in downtown Urbana. And then the evening show will, I believe, be at, if I can get the grid to come down for me,
6 p.m.
around 6 p.m. And I'm looking for your name here at the Heartland Gallery. Mm-hmm. Is where you'll be at 6 p.m. And go to folkandroots.org. That is the website of the CU Folk and Roots Festival to find out everything about attending events that are going on there. We have a couple of more minutes. You think we could sneak in another piece of music from you?
Well, let's play a fretless banjo.
Now, I was looking at this when you brought it out. Stephen, you gave a Millecom lecture yesterday at Spurlock Museum where you played. A fretless banjo looks like a more homemade banjo.
Like an axe handle. You know, it's simple. It's just a piece of, it's wood. It's no metal rim. A little possum skin or type of drum head.
Is that really possum skin?
No, but sometimes they're made out of cat skin. And sometimes they're made, in fact, the fellow who made this banjo said that his uncle, who was a banjo maker also, was at their house and he saw a cat walk by and he said, "That's a banjo on four legs."
Well, no fret, so none of those little raised ridges.
Wires. Yeah.
So you can sort of slide on the
swing. Oh, a softer and mellower sound.
Okay. What's the name of that?
Well, I was sort of putting together a thing called Cluck and Hen with a few other. I think I slipped into a little bit of Bilum Cabbage Down that African American banjoer from Appomattox, Virginia, by the name of Lewis Big Sweet Hairston played, and that's that part.
Okay.
And then the Cluck and Hen part is. It was always a sign of, if you could make a banjo talk, that was always a sign of, if someone said you could make that talk, that you'd done all right.
Well, you have three opportunities to see Stephen Wade at the CU Folk and Roots Festival. Of course, a lot of other music going on during Friday and Saturday at various venues in downtown Urbana. folkandroots.org is the name of the website to go to. They also have a Facebook page if you go searching for that. We're out of time, I'm afraid.
But it's great to meet you.
Well, Stephen, it's been great to have you on the program here. We've been talking about folk and roots music and about this weekend's 5th Annual Folk and Roots Festival with Stephen Wade and his and various musical instruments. Earlier, we talked to Brenda Koenig and Matt Winters, two of the organizers of the Folk and Roots Festival. And again, Stephen, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And I should note again, he's also the author of The Beautiful Music All Around Us, Field Recordings and the American Experience, published by the U of I Press. Most recent CD, Banjo Diary, Lessons from Tradition from Smithsonian Folkways. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, and you can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus, and we are likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Mike Pritchard engineered my interview with Brenda Koenig and Matt Winters. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Tomorrow on Focus, Frank Tavares. He is the man who voiced all those NPR News underwriting messages that you've heard hundreds, maybe thousands of times. Well, Frank is retiring from underwriting announcements, but he has other fish to fry, from teaching college communication courses to working on his short stories, a volume of which was recently published. We will get to know every facet of Frank Tavares on Friday's program. Maybe we'll get him to read an underwriting announcement as well while we're at it, maybe if we're very polite. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10, a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear us over the air on AM 580, online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.